Thanks very much indeed. And it's really a great pleasure to be here. There are many differences, I'm told, between economics and political science, but I can assure you, Professor Barrow, that the boredom of the meetings of the American Economic Association are excelled by none. It's also a pleasure to be here. This is actually my first visit to the Valley, even though I've lived in Texas for 30 years. So this is a good occasion for me, and it's particularly the case, and you mentioned the title of my chair, that to come here because the Benson political dynasty had its roots in the Texas Valley. And when I was awarded or elevated to the Lloyd Benson chair, Molly Ivins wrote in the Texas Observer that this was proof that God has a sense of humor. I inherited a needlepoint from my parents' household, which reads, Galbraith's Law, modesty is a vastly overrated virtue. And entitling this talk with two phrases that come from the titles of two of my books, I've acted on that principle. Let me begin by offering a pair of definitions. By predator state, I mean a national government whose politics are absorbed in the construction of complex deals in the spheres of social welfare, public investment, and regulation that have the effect of enriching specific private actors while passing along, perhaps, a diluted benefit to the broader public. Examples include efforts to privatize Social Security, the construction of Medicare Part D with its favors for the pharmaceutical business, the construction of Obamacare with its favors for private insurance, and the dawning era public-private infrastructure partnerships, if there is ever a bill to that effect, health savings accounts, the privatization of Veterans Administration and air traffic control, and of course the incorporation of the Environmental Protection Agency into the oil industry. I would not suggest that this is a partisan phenomenon. Differences between parties are a matter of degree. The nub, though, is that conservatives long ago accepted, I think, the 20th century reality that the modern economy is bound up inextricably in the state, that regulation is not a burden on private enterprise, but a necessary condition for its existence in most spheres of economic activity. And they have adopted their politics to this reality by making it essentially into a politics of skimming off of state structures rather than opposing them. Those who feel the pull of the 18th century, well, there are a few, Paul Ryan comes to mind, have tended to remain on the fringe, although in a few cases getting dangerously close to the levers of power. The rhetorical and political pull of the free market in this situation serves as mainly as a cudgel to discipline liberals and progressives and to prevent the development of a coherent worldview on the center left, so that left critics who speak with realism about the state are also marginalized within their own frame of political activity. That is to say, they're subordinated to a leadership which feels the urge on all occasions to pay obeisance and deference to the concepts of the free market and the free enterprise economy. I suspect that this feeling of marginalization is not entirely unfamiliar to you in this room. By poison chalice, on the other hand, I refer to the condition of democratic and progressive forces enmeshed in a web of state and also interstate structures, including treaties and trade agreements, both in Europe and in the United States, but in Europe, and especially in the case of Greece, these were predominantly creditor-debtor relationships that placed an absolute and strict limits on the margin of maneuver of any political forces and any national polity that might take it into its head to engage in rebellion. When I arrived in Athens on the 8th of February, 2015, which was the day of the opening of the Greek Parliament, and I went directly to the finance ministry, ascending to the sixth floor of a rather shabby office building, I have to tell you, to find the new finance minister sitting with his feet up on his desk. He said to me, "Welcome to the poison chalice." That was the first sentence that came out of his mouth. And it, I think, revealed what we already knew at the time, that there was no cause for any illusions about the prospects facing the government that had just been elected. Now, the concept of the predator state has its origins, actually, in a book that was published also 50 years ago. So 50 years ago, just at the time that this caucus was being formed. This is a book called The New Industrial State, my father's work. And its publication will be celebrated at the 50th anniversary. I think the only places that will be celebrated this time around are in St. Petersburg and Moscow in a few weeks. I bring the original with its just jacket to show you. I don't think you can see it. The jacket cover, which in our family was immediately christened with the caption, "Get up off the floor, both of you, and put on your clothes." It was an avant le deluge effort to wean economics from its competitive marketplace illusions by introducing the large corporation and its countervailing entities, unions, the government, civil society, the technical and scientific and intellectual estates. Of course, in the five decades since this book was published, American corporations have been largely destabilized. The unions have been crippled. The banks have returned to a central position that they did not hold in the middle 1960s. And the supporting institutions of the democratic, of the 20th century dispensation, which include Social Security, Medicare, public education, public infrastructure, as well as military procurement and research, have become, I think, central rather than peripheral and supporting elements of our economy. And that is why our politics have come to revolve around them. And this is what I think the shift of focus that I would urge everyone to consider and to bear in mind. It's not a description which fits for the entire world economy, but for the United States, it's relatively apt, because of the increasing asymmetry of world production systems and the moving of actual capital's production networks to other entities, notably to Asia, but also across the border here to Mexico. And the fact that the U.S. is able to maintain that position gives the predatory politics of the predator state a particular salience, I think, in our system. This political dispensation, I would argue, was fully formed by, at least the middle years of the Clinton administration, and it was the heart of our politics in the Bush years. There might have been some reason to hope when President Obama was elected that it would be contained, if not reversed, in the wake of the financial debacle. Unfortunately, no such luck, neither in the financial sphere nor in the way healthcare reform was designed. And the result has been an embedding of predatory encroachment of corporate interests in government on a bipartisan basis since at least the 1980s, with intellectual consequences that include the subsumption of public administration into such topics as outsourcing, transparency issues, civic engagements, performance metrics, and the like. Anything to disguise and distract from the erosion of an autonomous public power. Related phenomena include the public-private transactors, a wonderful phrase, word, and shadow elites, which have been described by the anthropologist Janine Waddell. All of which brings us, I think, to the condition of the Democratic Party. President Obama was elected on a surge of transracial popular enthusiasm in 2008, and he assembled a very adept campaign at the time, effectively using new technologies, with every prospect of building a renewed popular and participatory base for the Democratic Party. But that prospect would have been lethal for Wall Street. It would have placed a true power base that was not prepared to tolerate the conditions or preservation or resurrection of the conditions that had led to the financial crisis. And therefore, for that and perhaps other reasons, but I think for that reason predominantly, it was not pursued. Instead, over 8 years, the party was allowed, even encouraged, to wither away, which, as everyone here knows, is exactly what happened. And in fact, to abandon whatever base of popular organization it could have developed or was developing in the last years of the Bush administration. And what was left by the time Hillary Clinton assumed her role as the party's nominee was, let me suggest, largely a coterie of professional in and outers from finance, law, the Ivy Leagues, and the think tank world, whose focus was almost entirely on mission-specific career-building trajectories and backed politically by an operation whose major focus was advertising and polling. From a political standpoint, point of fact, there was no there. Hillary Clinton herself was scarcely an up-the-ranks politician. She emerged as the perfect representative of this class, a pure product of Wellesley, Yale, the Children's Defense Fund, the White House, and the Senate, and the State Department. Someone who did not have even her husband's brief rise through the backcountry politics of Arkansas. This was, and I say this not to disparage her personally, but what she was the quintessential representative of the new class, a phrase originated by Milovan Gilas many, many years ago in a 21st century American style. And let me say a word about the character of this class, because I think it was especially defined in certain ways by its economists, a group of very self-confident individuals who were, in a manner of speaking, willing and able to act as the agents of, let's say, the presentation of a certain image of the performance of the state, which was not a narrative that actually corresponded to the lived experience of many people out in the country, and who therefore, because they were speaking about things that people knew about from their personal lives, were especially open to being discredited by events. Who then is Donald Trump? Well, it seems to me that he was the perfect, and is the perfect vector of distaste for being ruled by polished know-it-alls, aggressively unanalytical, indifferent to facts, spontaneous, emotive, by no means stupid. Trump assembled what is effectively a coalition of anti-professionals, including fringe agitators, the white nationalists and racists of various types, but also some more centrally, the billionaire business types whose clear, metric of accomplishment is not intellectual or professional achievement, but rather the accumulation of piles and piles of money. Military officers with their own professional, but somewhat distant from intellectual lines of achievement, and working class voters who correctly recognized that major elements of the new class were practicing a kind of elite entitlement politics in the name of causes and groups whose underlying structure had lapsed to the point of being, I may be a little unfair, but I would say little more than email lists, chat rooms, and Facebook pages. Entities whose exposure to their members consists largely of frantic fundraising appeals. I don't wish to disparage the work of any particular group, but it should not be difficult to discern that when politics becomes largely the interaction of small issue advocacy groups with elite professional policymakers, a democratic deficit and a potential for a generalized revolt against that system may soon exist. Of course, political phenomena are rarely sui generis to a single country. And in Europe, much the same process unfolds in notably the collapse of the Parti Socialiste in France and in the Brexit referendum. The French Socialist Party represents almost exactly, it seems to me, the classes into which the American Democrats have dissolved: teachers, lawyers, bankers, economists, engineers, while the Front National is essentially Trumpism, national Gaullism plus xenophobia, and a half-hidden racist appeal. Brexit placed the professionals and bankers on one side and the disaffected working class on the other. And while the Leave campaign was disingenuous, and once it was elected, once it won the referendum, it proved to be utterly clueless about what to do. I was there at 4:30 in the morning watching the BBC as the gray-faced announcers came on with a kind of shocked aspect of what had happened, and shortly afterwards, I think it was Andrea Leadsom came on and said it was a time for mature reflection, and you thought, well, maybe a little late, don't you think? But while that was all true, the Remain campaign combined fear and condescension in an almost perfect self-parody, with The Economist leading the way, once again, in disgracing themselves with doomsday predictions that no sober analysis could have sustained, and in fact, which have not been borne out, which will, I hope, discredit the professional economists even further, although it's hard to see after how, after the great financial crisis, which they didn't foresee, and the great collapse following Brexit, which they did foresee but didn't happen, they could be discredited even further than they already are, but somehow they're still there. What makes the political diversity of Europe, however, interesting, is that there is a capacity for other combinations to emerge, possibly by happenstance, but in any event, that is what happened in one small country on the edge of the European Union, that is to say in Greece, in early 2015. And I want to say a few words about that because I did have a close personal connection to those events, and I was working on them basically around the clock for the 5 weeks, 5 months of the Varoufakis ministry in Athens. I was mostly here, but going back and forth and as needed, and working basically as one does over by remote connections. The Greek upheaval flowed, I think as everybody knows, from an unusually harsh, indeed catastrophic application of neoliberal austerity to a weak and corrupted country. But it required also another ingredient, which was that there emerged a coherent, clearly articulated alternative, which is what Syriza and largely Yanis Varoufakis provided in the run-up to the 2015 election. So there was, in fact, in this particular case, as there was not, I think, so strongly in Spain or Portugal in later elections, something which effectively represented both in Greek and in English for a larger audience, a fully fledged program of proposed changes in the European order. And when the Greek government went into negotiations in February of 2015 in Brussels on the 11th, I was there, it had a dossier of specific minimal objectives to present to its negotiating partners, something that it wasn't exactly prepared to carry out negotiations at a high level, but it did have an idea of what it wanted. And there were four elements to this, specifically a realistic fiscal target, not the 3.5 or 4.5% of GDP primary surpluses, which had been put into the program because the IMF insisted on a debt sustainability analysis, which was disconnected from reality, but at least the numbers looked like they might hold up. Secondly, international labor standards consistent with those offered for the rest of Europe by the ILO, rather than an unethical experiment in complete labor market deregulation and with the objective of internal devaluation to restore the so-called competitiveness of Greek industry, something that could never be restored under present conditions, even if the Greeks agreed to work for free. Thirdly, minimum pensions, that is to say, no further severe cuts in pensions, which for many hundreds of thousands of Greeks were already back down to about 350 euro a month, which is not a lot of money to live on. Fourth, a privatization program that did not consist of placing every single state asset on the auction block at the same time, a proposition which even the dullest neoclassical economist will admit is not likely to get you a good price from your bidders. No one ever argued the merits of these positions. It was and also a test case for a program, you could call it a radical program, but in any event, a coherent opposition program to what had been imposed on Greece for the previous 5 years, that was backed also by massive popular support. I said to the Vice Prime Minister Dragosakis in Brussels on the 12th of February, when a poll came out showing that they had 80% popular approval, and this is like half the people who voted against them were in favor of what of their program 3 weeks after the election. I said, enjoy it, you're never going to see this again. That's where we were. Interest of the case, that is to say, the definition of what I've called the poison chalice, lies in what happened. Discussions occurred on three levels. At the technical level, there were negotiations with the Troika, which were not negotiations. The Troika, of course, is the IMF, the European Central Bank, the European Commission. The representatives of those agencies were entirely concerned with their own institutional power, and they had no authority to make reciprocal concessions. So their practice was when they would talk the Greeks into doing something, they'd say, that's fine, pocket that concession, now let's go on to the next one. Their instructions were to report up to their institutional masters that on the performance of the Greeks with respect to the existing financial program, not to make any changes. At a higher level, we had the Eurogroup, an ad hoc collection of the 19 finance ministers of the countries in the Euro, which met at an appallingly frequent schedule, every several weeks, or it seemed that way, it might have been every month. But an event involving four-hour flights from all corners of Europe in order to hear the finance ministers make speeches basically based entirely on their local politics. The East Europeans were committed austerity ideologues. The Iberians didn't want to make concessions because they didn't want to give encouragement to Podemos or the Bloc Izquierda. The French and the Italians were sympathetic but didn't want to use any political capital. And the Germans, of course, were trying to impose a program on France and on Paris and Rome, and they were therefore not going to make any concessions to the Greeks. That's in fact what Wolfgang Schäuble said to Yanis Varoufakis directly and personally was his reasons. And then, so we had no chance at the finance ministerial level, we knew that. And so we moved up and tried to deal at what was called the political level, that is to say directly between the Prime Minister, Alexis Tsipras, and the Chancellor, Angela Merkel, with the sympathetic intervention of anybody we might be able to engage, including the government of the United States. And the government of the United States was in fact sympathetic. It listened to our position, and it constantly reiterated its desire for there to be a reasonable compromise. But when it came to putting pressure on the Germans, the government of the United States had a higher priority, which was Ukraine. And for that reason, primarily, they were not going to use any pressure tactics on the Germans. So the net of this is that the issue of what was good for Greece, of what would constitute a program that might stabilize, let alone restore, the Greek economy, that might bring an end to 25% unemployment, 60% youth unemployment, complete collapse of the major public services, healthcare, education, transport, and so forth. Not complete collapse, but very, very severe stress. And the impoverishment of the elderly population of Greece, as well as the bankruptcy of Greek businesses, and the path to foreclosure for massive numbers of Greek households, was never engaged at all. What was what Greece faced instead was a financial squeeze, and payment deadlines, together with destabilizing pressure from the European Central Bank, intended to force either the capitulation or the collapse of the government. And capitulation is, of course, what did happen in July of 2015. So the combination, I would argue, of an entitled professional political administrative class and a rigidly interlocked set of institutional interests, which is perhaps a synthetic view of the political condition of North America and Europe at the present time, surely signals a system in serious decline with fragilities and vulnerabilities that may in some ways not be unlike those that faced the USSR in the 1980s or Yugoslavia at the end of that decade. When the concept which is where, of course, the concept of a new class was articulated a half century before. Bannonism consists precisely in forging an alliance, as they say, of business billionaires, a pure money elite, and angry non-professionals to break the system. So while we think about historical parallels for Donald Trump, I would suggest that Boris Yeltsin might not be a bad one. Trump is still sober, but who knows, the pressures of the office may drive him to drink. The result is what we observe now, which is, let's call it a fuck you administration designed to infuriate professionals of all types, to give business free reign over certain particular spheres, and to chase away or to disenfranchise identity-based minorities and immigrants who have backed the professionals without getting much in return save symbolic representation. How to proceed in these circumstances? It's a tough question. It's a question for which I have no ready answer. That's why we're here, I hope, to talk about it. But let me suggest that the answer begins with an understanding that we will need to have true political empowerment, organization, engagement, a civic force which has not been present for many, many years on the left, based, I would trust, on actual democratic principles, and that we who are professionals who wish to participate should support rather than short-circuit the resulting formations, and should not expect to form a permanent state nomenclatura all by ourselves. So let us engage, let us assist in bearing witness, let us bear witness ourselves, let us report on what is actually happening in our communities and hope that those voices begin to consolidate and carry in the face of the various insults to common decency which are presently going on. But let us always remember, and perhaps this is an overly familiar line, but in the immortal words of Pogo, we have met the enemy and he is us. Thank you.